You've taken your first step into a larger world. Let's go.
Hello there. I'm Rowan Williams.
I'm Baz McAllister.
And welcome to Force Material, where today we are joined by a very special guest for day one of our virtual Star Wars celebration. If you're the type of person who watches special features on DVDs and Blu-rays, and if you're listening to this show, chances are you probably are, then you know Charles de Lozarica is the maker of making-ofs. He's the award-winning filmmaker responsible for directing classic behind-the-scenes documentaries and producing feature-packed DVD and Blu-ray sets for the likes of Blade Runner, Twin Peaks, and the Alien franchise. He's overseen numerous restorations and new cuts of those films, including Blade Runner, The Final Cut, and Alien 3, The Assembly Cut, the only way to watch those movies now as far as I'm concerned. But he's also a big Star Wars fan, and that's why he's here to nerd out with us today. Charles, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a lot of fun. It's nice to talk about something other than Alien, Blade Runner, or Twin Peaks for a change.
Exactly. Now, you one of the reasons we wanted to get in touch with you is because you were actually at the very first sort of major Star Wars convention back in the day. In 1987, Starlog magazine held an event called Starlog Salutes Star Wars, and you were there. What kind of brought you to that event?
Well, I mean, look, I was a Star Wars mega fan since day one. I mean, I saw Star Wars at the Chinese Theater on Saturday, May 26th, 1977. Yeah. I guess. I was a super fan for all those years. And 87, the 10th anniversary, was kind of a big year because it wasn't just this convention. It was also Star Tours opened up. So I kind of feel like just everyone in the Star Wars community, especially in Southern California, were really, really hyped up on Star Wars at that point. So being a Starlog reader and just kind of keeping track of all the events that were happening in Southern California all the time, other science fiction conventions, this one was like, you had to be there. You know, if you love Star Wars, you absolutely had to be there. So myself and several friends went down to the Stouffer Hotel, I think it was called, by LAX. And it was you know, a weekend of just Star Wars craziness and fun and just... even thinking about it now, it's just so silly that we spent an entire weekend about nothing but Star Wars. But now when you look at Star Wars Celebration and it's such a huge epic event, it's like it was so tiny compared to what it is now. So it's really funny how times have changed.
Yeah. And there were over like 5,000 people in attendance there, I think. I mean, did it feel like packed? Like how was the sort of vibe at the convention?
It was packed, especially on the day that George Lucas was there. That was the big event that everyone, you know, wanted to be there for. Because you have to understand, this was only, 4 years after Jedi had released and kind of, like, went on its way. And we all thought Star Wars was kind of over for the most part, at least for a period of time. And so that George was coming down off the mountain to give us the new wisdom, the new knowledge, whatever it is that he was going to share, we all had to be there for that. It was a pilgrimage. So that I remember that day when George was on stage and a lot of other VIPs there, it was packed, and it was packed actually to the point of a lot of angry people. It was almost like an angry mob before the show began because people were like, you know, their seats were being challenged and people were getting in front of them and they're like, get out of the way. And there was a lot. I mean, seriously, I have video of it. I shot video of the whole thing and I have video of angry people complaining about, you know, the situation. So, like, that's how it started.
So nothing's changed, essentially, is what you're saying.
No. A lot of angry Star Wars fans.
And that was, so George Lucas was there, obviously. And is that's, so you were there when George met Gene Roddenberry then?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. I lucked out. I was in the front row, right front and center, because I was writing, I believe this was around the time I might have started writing for my college newspaper. And so I started doing like entertainment journalism, quote unquote, going to, you know, press conferences and screenings and whatever. So I think I might have leveraged my little community college press credentials to get to the front row of that. But yeah, right there for Gene Roddenberry and Irvin Kershner was there. Gary Kurtz was there. I'm trying to think who else was there. Like Charles Lippincott, who we just lost sadly, he was up on stage. Yeah. Sid Gannis, who was head of marketing for Lucasfilm at the time, I believe. So, yeah, it was. I mean, it was like really great to see all these VIPs, and then also Kerry O'Quinn, who ran Starlog, was the host, was the MC of it, and he read a lot of letters from people who couldn't be there, like from Carrie Fisher and President Carter, and it's like all these random people
wow.
sent letters in, you know. But it was a really special moment, just having all those people on stage, having all that kind of love directed straight at George from multiple angles. It was a really fun day, and it was very I don't know. It was almost like a religious experience. It really was. It was just kind of like just the vibe in that room was so intense and so full of love, passion, anger, but like not mean anger, more like I want to know what's next, or I want to know what's coming up, and don't leave us hanging. Don't leave us hanging. You know, it was kind of like that vibe.
Yeah, because this was the dark time, wasn't it? It was the 10-year anniversary of the first film, a few years after Jedi. Star Tours had opened, as you said, I guess, but there was no merchandise, there was no figures coming out, there was no sense of any other, you know, films coming on the horizon or anything like that. So I guess you were one of the 5,000 that kept the flame of remembrance burning during the dark times at this thing.
Yeah, it was interesting because you could tell that the various entities involved were testing the waters and how to possibly continue Star Wars. Like Kenner came out with that first Power of the Force action figure set that was like before the big muscular ones that came years later.
Yeah.
But that first set was actually really nice, the Power of the Force. And that was kind of like an 85, I believe, 85, 86. So that was kind of like testing the waters of can they continue selling toys. And then, of course, Star Tours was a major, major event. But I wouldn't call that exactly the dark times, but it's definitely kind of like the fade. It was the beginning of the fade. Like, it was starting to kind of like, we're all trying to find new things to do with our lives. But always, again, like you say, keeping the flame alive for whatever was next, for sure.
Mm. Was there any sense at that convention of, you know, like, did they tease at all, like, prequels or anything that was coming up in the future? Or was he happy to just sort of leave people hanging?
Well, it's interesting because I feel that, you know, fans are very imaginative, and they they hear things. They'll say, "Oh, I heard in the street that such and such is doing so and so," and this is like it's kind of funny the way that facts, quote unquote, get into the conversation. So yes. I remember when George was on stage doing Q&A with the audience, there was someone who I think I actually knew back then. She called out from the back of the audience and she said, "There's a rumor in the industry that you've already begun pre-production on Star Wars Episode 1. Please comment on what you're doing on Episode 1." And this, of course, being May 1987. And George just said, "That is untrue." And so that there was like this sense of like people not being able to let go. Mm. And they had to construct and just conjure and imagine what the next chapter of Star Wars would be, whether it was a ride or a comic book or a movie or whatever, but they needed to know what was next. So I sensed a lot of desperation in that hall of people just like, tell us what's next beyond Star Tours, which is obvious because that was already happening. But there was a lot of talk about like, not a lot, but I mean, George talked more about like Indy 3, you know, before it was Last Crusade. He was talking about that a bit. He was really big on Willow because he was 5 weeks into shooting Willow at that time. So, you know, it was little dribs and drabs and just kind of hints, but like nothing too solid other than what he was actually working on at the time. He was not anywhere close to talking about what the prequels could be. Mm. You know, people were asking very kind of sideways questions, trying to get at something that would give him a little hint of what was to come, but he was not giving it up.
There were a lot of other like Star Wars celebs in attendance as well. I think Billy Dee Williams was there, Peter Mayhew, Anthony Daniels, the late Gary Kurtz. Did you have a chance to sort of catch any of those guys?
Peter Mayhew, Anthony Daniels. Didn't see Billy Dee Williams there, although I did direct Billy Dee Williams in a music video years after that, like
yeah,
10 years after that. But no, I don't remember him being there. It's possible he was. It's interesting because it wasn't as organized as conventions are today in terms of like you have your autograph section, you've got, you know exactly where to go at exactly what time. It's very organized. Back then it was a little more freeform and a little more, I don't know, you just had to be at the right place at the right time sometimes. Mm-hmm. They had a big like archive room, like a Lucasfilm archives that had props and costumes and matte paintings and things from the original trilogy. I got my picture taken with R2-D2, and they had Luke's lightsaber from Return of the Jedi there that you could pose with, so I did that as well. So it was like, it was, you know, it was, again, it was a humble beginning for what would eventually become Star Wars Celebration as we know it. I mean, not that it was the exact same, you know, lineage, but it still had that. Mm. That was the first like pure Star Wars convention, which was weird for us because it was like, again, you go to a convention and it's like multi-film, multi-IP, multi-genre, whatever. Mm. This was nothing but Star Wars. So like that was a new thing to kind of like get excited about, but we didn't know. I don't think anyone knew what that meant in terms of what you would do as a one-off standalone Star Wars convention.
It's funny though, that lineage from this to Star Wars Celebration, because like we mentioned before, you know, George and Gene Roddenberry, I think this is, I don't know if it's the only time they met, but it's definitely the only time they were photographed together. And that photo was apparently taken by Dan Madsen, who then went on to organize the first Star Wars Celebration. So there are those little sort of bits of Star Wars Celebration DNA in this thing all the way back in 1987.
Sure, yeah. I mean, that was a pretty big moment when Gene Roddenberry showed up and shook his hand, and it was like really the two greats, you know, on the stage together. And you could just tell, because you know, even though ostensibly everyone there is a Star Wars fan, you know a huge percentage there is also are also Star Trek fans. So it was like, it was just seeing those two together. It was pretty orgasmic, I think, for a lot of people.
Was Star Wars versus Star Trek like already a thing back then, or was it more like people, you know, were just into both?
I only remember it like conversationally being a conflict. I don't remember it actually being like, I don't know anyone that was purely Star Wars so much that they would hate Star Trek because of it, or vice versa.
Yeah.
I just knew people that would lean one way or the other, but they tended to like both. It'd be their day one of either of those franchises films. So, I remember fandom back then not being as contentious as it is now, but of course we didn't have the internet. We didn't have message boards. You know, you literally had letters to the editor in Starlog magazine. And that was kind of like all you had in terms of communication.
Well, it's funny because people always say now, like when they go to Star Wars Celebration, people are like, oh, you know, everybody's so friendly. It's so different than like Star Wars Twitter or whatever. And it's like, yeah, well, because people generally don't say things in person that they would say on the internet. So I guess it makes sense.
No. Yeah, no, I never sensed any of that kind of tension back then, really. It was just, again, more frustration of what's next, because people, myself included, had invested so much of our childhood into Star Wars and George Lucas that it is kind of like, well, what now? You know, it's like, what after all of this, after all this investment and time of waiting 3 years between movies, of buying all these toys, just all this stuff that we have now amassed, what now? What next? So it took a little while, I think, for a lot of us to grow up beyond that, to realize, oh, there's a whole world out there of other things we could fall in love with and explore and cherish, you know?
Yeah.
Back then, we all kind of got stuck in Star Wars for a decade, I think a solid decade of like, wait, what else is there, you know?
It's funny to think that with keen marketing minds there, like Charles Lippincott and Sid Gannis, they might have been trying to figure out what a roadmap out of this would be, what the fans had an appetite for, I suppose. That might have been sort of part of the inspiration behind organizing it.
Well, I'm sure that also drove what would eventually become like, you know, the novels and the expanded universe and all of those things to just kind of feed the machine. And I don't mean necessarily the money machine. I mean, just like the fan machine. Like they, you know, they want content. They want stories. They want to know what's next. They want to know what happened to these characters that they love so much. So, you know, that's tough when that is not your 24/7 job. And obviously George wanted to take some time off and do other things. So, without having the creator, the maker, you know, pumping out this stuff, it was kind of slim pickings for a while, and in very tentative steps, you know, with like Heir to the Empire and things like that coming out to kind of start to get the ball rolling, you know. It was strange those days. I mean, I remember certainly from like 87 to 95, which is I think when the next Power of the Force figures came out, if I'm not mistaken, around that time.
Yeah,
that was definitely the dark time. Like that was like there was almost nothing to talk about. I mean, I think even like the Star Wars fan club and Bantha Tracks, I think even that shut down at some point, I feel like, or they at least cooled off for a bit and then were reborn later. But I think it was kind of needed for a lot of us because we were so focused on it. We needed to like have that, you know, have get kicked out of the nest. You know, have that Band-Aid ripped off. Just kind of like, let's move on with our life. Let's get on beyond Star Wars, at least for a little bit of our adulthood. let's kind of grow up for a second.
Maybe that's what the cancellation celebration is going to do for us all now. We're just going to have that Band-Aid ripped off. You know?
Well, I mean, it's tricky, though, because I was going to say, just like, you know, with Episode 9 now being done, and although, you know, Mandalorian is obviously doing really well, but I mean, it's like now we're almost in that same position again. Like, what's next? Now we have another gap of like, what's the next movie going to be? What's it going to be about? And I know there's all these different plans for like, you know, the High Republic and all these other offshoots, but it's sort of like, you know, it, I think Star Wars fans always need to know what is that sort of North Star to aim at? Like, what is, what, where are we all going?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And now we're in that zone again of like, what is it? You know, who's going to decide that? And what is that direction? What is that story?
Yeah. I mean, is, from your perspective, like, is there anything that you, like, is there a particular era you'd like to see them explore in the films or anything like that?
I mean, I'm really, to be honest, I'm enjoying Mandalorian in terms of like that period of post Jedi history that, you know, we still need much filled in terms of film and TV stories. You know, I'm sure books and comics are going to fill it up, you know, to the nth degree, but I'm very curious about that era. I think it's really interesting to be there sort of post fall of the Empire and how everyone finds their new role in the universe. And, you know, hopefully Mandalorian will develop and become more intricate and complicated, and not complicated, that's the wrong term, but complex and just kind of more, go a little bit beyond the episodic format it's in right now, which is, it's nice, it's clean, it's simple, it's like an 80s episodic television, it's like A-Team in space. It's
great.
But the last two episodes of Mandalorian really felt like, okay, now we're going to start building towards a longer story arc and something that's a little bit more, you know, developed than just, you know, Mando mission of the week.
Yeah.
You know, so, so I'm really curious about that. I think that is a really fertile era in Star Wars history that could still be developed quite well. You know, I'm a little personally a little bit done with pre A New Hope era. You know, I mean, it's like I'll check it out for sure. But it's like whenever I hear of anything in that realm, I'm sort of like, oh, okay, that's maybe someone else will really enjoy that, and I can focus on other things. You know, but there's, that's the great thing about Star Wars. Like, there's always something for everybody, no matter what angle you approach it from. And it shouldn't always be about what I want. I was one fan. So I hope we all get like a nice little piece of the galaxy moving forward.
Yeah, it's funny how time moves on and we've evolved, and there are now like Gen X Star Wars fans who want one thing out of Star Wars, Gen Ys who want another. And, you know, I think that why I respond to The Mandalorian so well really is because the people driving that creative project are my kind of age, and they have the same cultural touchstones of Star Wars as I did, and, you know, that kind of thing. So yeah, Favreau's what, early 50s, and Dave Filoni's like 46 or something like that. So, you know, they're all coming from the same sort of place as me.
Well, I think it was in the last episode of Gallery of the Making of the Mandalorian that's on Disney Plus right now. I think it was the last, it was one of the last couple ones, but how Jon Favreau was talking about how he was really inspired, not so much by Star Wars, but by the things that inspired George Lucas to make Star Wars, like, you know, Kurosawa and Westerns and World War II and those types of things. And I think that is a really smart approach to kind of like reverse engineering and unlocking the secret DNA of Star Wars, is to go to what George was inspired by and then build from there, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So going back to the beginning, I guess, of the Charles DeLorzerica Star Wars story, what is your earliest Star Wars memory?
My early Star Wars memory, I believe it was my dad showing me an issue of Time magazine, and I believe it was that famous photo of the X-Wing being chased by the TIE fighter and the two bolts kind of flying by the TIE fighter, or by the X-Wing.
Yep.
That was like my first vague memory, but then I remember him taking me to the Mann's Chinese Theater on Saturday, May 26, 1977. Yeah. And again, I knew virtually nothing about Star Wars other than that it seemed like this really cool, exciting thing. But I remember being in the courtyard of the Chinese, and they had the displays with the lobby cards and the posters. And one of the lobby cards was, and in retrospect, a big spoiler, it was the kind of overhead shot of Han and Luke at the award ceremony and Chewie walking behind them, right?
Yeah, right.
The final scene of the movie is on a lobby card. But I remember that as a kid thinking, oh man, those two guys have been captured by that giant ape, and the ape is taking them to his leader. And they have to talk their way out of it, you know? but that was what was great about Star Wars. Like, immediately your little child brain starts generating a story just off of this simple imagery.
Yeah.
So that was that. And then we went inside. And of course, as everyone tells the same story a million times, you know, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, and that huge music hit, and then the logo flying out. And I really felt like as that was happening, my brain was being absolutely reprogrammed. I felt like the little like knobs and switches and stuff in my brain was just like totally on overdrive. And and it was, and then just seeing the crawl go up. And like, these are things that, you know, keep in mind, our parents saw in the Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers serials. I mean, they saw elements of this. They saw stuff that George was kind of like intentionally borrowing from other places. But as a kid in 1977, that was like, I didn't know you could do that. You know, I didn't know, you know, basically it was like 2 hours of, I didn't know you could do that, you know? and so that, that opening shot of, I mean, it wasn't even just the Star Destroyer. It was the tilt down, the Tatooine, that blue thin atmosphere above it. And it's like, you were just immediately thinking, I am in space. I am actually there, you know?
Yeah.
So the feeling that it had this tactile, very kind of just visceral feeling, this organic, almost like documentary from another galaxy feeling with the used future, all the stuff that people talk about, they've talked about it. That is so true, especially when you have an audience of millions and millions of people who had never seen that before. You know, it was such a groundbreaking, like just bolt from the blue of like, oh my God, this is a whole new, not only way to enjoy stories and filmmaking, but how to make them, which we eventually learned, you know, in the months that followed, because then George Lucas started sharing the secrets, you know? So all of 1977 was just like being reprogrammed by Star Wars to like not only enjoy it and know the universe and want more, but also maybe how you could be a part of it yourself. That was the most empowering thing about Star Wars, was the fact that some guy, you know, up in Northern California did this. He got a bunch of people together and they made this thing. You can too. You know, you can blow up little things in front of a blue screen, and, you know, you can make little monsters and stop motion animation. And, you know, that was so beautiful about the whole experience, was not just how awesome this universe was, but that you could be a part of it and you could actually make your own things.
Yeah. Well, is it true that you did some work for Lucasfilm while you were studying at USC? Like, what was your sort of earliest, like the first time you kind of crossed paths with that world?
I'd sort of been crossing paths with people at Lucasfilm or working on the films, just very tangentially, and being in LA, you know, I mean, I met Steve Sansweet, for instance, at swap meets, you know, going, he was dumpster diving, looking for the old Star Wars stuff that's still around. And I was too. And that's how we met. And he had me over to his house in Silver Lake, the old house he used to have. And I started crying because I realized I could never catch up to him. But those are like the early hints of Star Wars and Lucasfilm. But then when I was at USC Film School, and of course I went to USC Film School because George Lucas went to USC Film School, I applied for an internship at Lucasfilm. I got accepted. And so in the summer of 94, I was a Lucasfilm intern for Skywalker Sound. And, wow. And that was the first time I got to go to Skywalker Ranch. It was for the 4th of July picnic in 94. That was amazing. My girlfriend at the time almost knocked George over, and I thought my career was over. There's like a big potluck table, and she had a bowl of, like, I don't know, some kind of potato salad, and she literally turned right into George, and just my brain went to slow motion as I reached out. I was like, no. So that was an amazing, that was going to the ranch the first time was absolutely incredible. Like, that was a dream come true.
Yeah. Sure. What sort of projects did you work on, like, when you were kind of interning there?
Well, so it was the summer of 94, and there were two films, as I recall. There was James Gray's film Little Odessa with Tim Roth and Edward Furlong. And then there was True Lies, James Cameron's film.
Wow.
And I don't know, the pressure on the True Lies stage where they were working, I tended to hang out on the Little Odessa stage. Because they were really, really cool and mellow, and we'd talk about movies all day long, and Stanley Kubrick, and just we'd like get kind of like more, you know, film centric. Whereas over on the True Lies stage, it was just like the pressure to finish. We got to finish. So
yeah,
but it was fun. It was definitely a lot of very interesting experiences. While I was an intern at Skywalker Sound South in LA, we were all there, and it was the day of the O.J. Simpson white Bronco chase.
Yeah, right.
Wow.
And Skywalker South was right next to the 405 freeway that OJ was racing down. And, you know, everyone stopped work. And one of the mixing stages with the big, you know, THX calibrated theater and screen, all that, we were watching the news of the white Bronco essentially driving like blocks away from where we were. So that was a very interesting summer. That was, summer 94.
Now, this is a couple of years, I guess, at this point, before the Star Wars Special Edition comes out. You're a man who knows his way around a director's cut, an alternate cut of a movie. I mean, do you remember being like excited for the Special Edition? Like, what was your feeling about it at the time?
Well, when I first heard about them doing it, I thought, oh, they would go in and recomposite some of the old opticals. They would kind of clean it up. Maybe they would make some tweaks here and there. I had no idea it was going to be as big in terms of the differences and the changes that were being done. And as it turns out, I got lucky enough to be invited to a test screening of Star Wars Special Edition.
Wow.
Out in the valley that, you know, we waited hours online for. And we got in, and it was a big, you know, it was a test screening, but it was also kind of a marketing event where they were like recording fans coming out of the theater, like, what'd you think? And they would give you, you know, their little 30-second review. So it was interesting for me. It was an interesting experience. And it was the first time I realized that Star Wars is not perfect. It wasn't precious. It wasn't like this, you know, holy grail that I had to just keep on a pedestal. That it was something I could analyze and critique and say, okay, well, maybe they shouldn't have done that. That was interesting. That was cool, but that doesn't seem to work as well. I mean, I started like actually being more analytical about it. And a lot of what I learned from that experience, I applied to what would then become the Blade Runner Final Cut. Was just my philosophy on that was, you know, don't do anything that takes the audience out of the movie. Because Star Wars Special Edition, to me, even though I thought there were some good fixes, there were also fixes that I didn't think were needed, first of all, but also took me completely out of the film, because now I had to completely rethink, do I like this? You know, do I like the swoop missing the Ronto and the Jawa falling off and all that? Do I like that? And if I'm stopping my experience with the film to now suddenly have a sidebar with myself to talk about, is that good? Did that help? Did it make it better? I wonder if that's maybe not the way to go, but that might not have been the purpose of it. The purpose of it might have just been R&D for the prequels, you know, to really have George kind of experiment and try things out, create a new version that gets people to see it back in on the big screen in theaters, which all that I love. Like, that's great stuff to do that. It was just the actual changes themselves, which we have now seen have changed multiple times since. You know, those things I still keep in a separate category of my love of Star Wars. Like, there's the film that I love. Special editions are a separate conversation that don't affect my love of the film, but I can still have a very detailed conversation about those other things, as I'm sure every single fan out there can.
Yeah.
Everyone has their own opinion. I mean, what did you think? Did you guys like the special editions? I mean, what did you think?
Well, I mean, for me, like, I was like 10 or 11 when the special edition came out. So that was the first time I'd seen Star Wars in a movie theater. So it's kind of one of those things, like, you hear people who like grew up with the prequels as their introduction to Star Wars, who really, really love the prequels because that's Star Wars to them. It has like a very nostalgic appeal to me, just the 97 cut in particular, which doesn't really exist anymore because, you know, like, they've made further changes, as you said, in the, you know, the like the home video releases after that. So like, I could never like sort of hate on the special editions the way that some people do, because that was like, that was my, you know, man's Chinese theater, Saturday, May 26, 1977, like going in and sort of seeing it on the big screen with, you know, a packed audience. I think some of the changes were unnecessary and kind of silly, like, especially with Return of the Jedi. With Star Wars, I'm kind of like ambivalent about most of it. But yeah, I kind of have a soft spot for it. Baz, what about you?
Yeah, well, I was in my early 20s and living in Glasgow around the time the special editions came out. So I kind of got spoiled because the Glasgow Film Theatre and one of the big cinemas there, they put on regular marathons of the three. And, you know, I would go and see them before special editions came out. But I remember it being such a special occasion that it kind of became that start of the tradition of getting a group of friends together to go and see a big event Star Wars film, you know, the special edition coming out. And yeah, I mean, the cut itself, like, I think I'm with you, Charles. It kind of made me think about what I love, because this kind of, you know, King James version had been updated to something else, and sure. You're like, oh well, how can both be true? And yeah, some of the changes I didn't love. Like, I knew about the scene with Declan Mulholland, you know, as Jabba. And I'd seen footage of that somewhere, I think, and I can't remember where. And I know that that was incorporated into the radio plays as a different character called Heater. And I remember thinking that was kind of a wasted opportunity to just redo the dialogue and have that character be Heater, you know?
You were like the one person in the audience who was like, you wanted the Heater cut. You wanted to see the other.
I know, I didn't want to see Jabba.
I mean, that scene, I mean, it was interesting to see for sure, because I like the scene you're talking about, the original un-CG version, which was known in from Star Wars, The Jedi, the Making of a Saga documentary. That was the first time I think any of us saw footage from that. And so it's really great to see it. But if you think about it, it's really an unnecessary, or at least it's a redundant scene, because Jabba schleps all the way down to, you know, docking bay himself with not only his usual guys, but then now newly Boba Fett added. So the baddest bounty hunter in the galaxy is suddenly, he's also kind of just schlepping along, like, to get Han to pay up. And I'm thinking, Greedo covered all this in the previous scene. And on top of that, it now spoils the reveal of the Falcon, because there's that beautiful, when they're coming down the steps, that beautiful shot where we pan with them, we reveal the Falcon, the music lifts. And then Luke says, "What a piece of junk." It's like, that is absolutely the perfect reveal of the Falcon. Now that is completely derailed because we're seeing the Falcon. It's like this generic backdrop for this scene. So it's like, super interesting to finally see. I love that we've, you know, gotten to enjoy it, but I wish it was a deleted scene and not actually in the cut.
Yeah. I kind of, it's weird, because I agree with everything you're saying. Like, especially like you watch it now and you know, like, Greedo gives Han all of that information in the previous scene. There's no reason for that scene to happen. Like, as you say, spoils the reveal of the Falcon, spoils the reveal of Jabba if you're watching the, you know, the trilogy for the first time. Having said that, I will always remember being at that first special edition screening and everyone kind of knowing that that was the first, like, big new scene. You know, there'd been additions to the Mos Eisley thing and other things before that, but that was the scene that, like, the ads were built around, and it was like, you know, oh, they're going to see Jabba, like a CG version of Jabba in the in Star Wars. And when that scene came on, and then the bit that everybody kills it for now, when he steps on the tail, that's awful. But at the time, that killed. Like, the crowd lost it when he like stepped over his tail. Like, people thought that was the funniest thing. So it's like, I know it's bad on like an intellectual level, but I still kind of love it.
I think about that moment a lot, the stepping on the tail bit. Not a lot in my real life, but a lot when we're talking about Star. But I think about, like, you know, if only they could have done like a little cutaway to at that moment where Harrison Ford passes around and they have to do something with it. Why not cut to Chewie making eye contact with Boba Fett? Boba Fett has Wookiee scalps on his costume, right? So there could be a little bit of, like, you know, "What's up, bitch?" Like, looking back and forth to each other.
Yeah.
And then you cover that awkward transition, but you get some character moments between Chewie and Boba Fett.
Yeah.
That in my thinking is what I would do, but of course it's not my movie, so.
Well, then as well, like, you get your, you know, your Boba Fett moment without having to have Boba Fett sort of like stop and turn and look directly at the camera at the end of that scene. So yeah, it would have fixed a couple of things with that scene, I guess.
It's like, if you can see through Boba Fett's visor, you can imagine him winking at the camera.
He's breaking the fourth wall going, I can't believe I'm debt collecting. Like, I should be disintegrating people.
Do you, were there changes that really worked for you in those special editions? Like, was there any that you kind of remember as being like, yeah, that was, the film is better for having that in it?
I wouldn't say that the film is better necessarily, but that there were slight improvements that I thought, you know, I can live with that. That's cool. I mean, like the additional shot of the Falcon taking off out of Mos Eisley, I thought that, or the new version of that shot was nice. The like the little aerial looking down as it's taking off is nice. I'm trying to think of other things. I mean, generally the cleanup work I thought was pretty nicely handled. I mean, like the little tiny polishes that no one would even care about. The big shot of the Rebel Armada flying by a camera towards Death Star was impressed, very impressive at the time. Like that, I remember, was like the big shot that everyone was like, "Oh my God, that's super cool to see!" Not just the scope of the Rebel, you know, ships, but, you know, kind of like people living inside the cockpits, and you could actually see like real pilots at work. But beyond that, I'm just trying to think of things like, again, we talked about the Jabba scene. That was the big one. I don't know. There's like little bits and pieces in the Star Wars Special Edition that are, I'm okay with. It's more when we get into Empire and Jedi that I have bigger issues about. In Empire, as much as I think that the new Wampa footage was well shot and executed and the creature looks good, again, it kind of like forces your imagination to accept what it is versus what you might not see. You know, it's like when, in the original 1980 version, you only saw like a little bit of arm and a little bit of movement and just like a suggestion of what the Wampa was. So your imagination took over and filled in all the blanks and made it probably more menacing and terrifying than what we saw in the special edition, which is, you know, beautifully executed creature and it comes out very nicely. But now your imagination has less to do, has less work to do. So I think it's very important to let your imagination engage and kind of fill in blanks and build out the universe more than what we're actually seeing on the screen. I'm not a big fan of Rebel or of Vader saying, you know, originally saying, bring my shuttle to now alert my Star Destroyer to prepare for my arrival.
Yeah.
Unnecessary, that whole bit of the shuttle, you know, basically chasing the Falcon to get to the Executor first. Like, none of that was necessary. It threw off the pacing, the music, which is so beautifully paced before, is now chopped up.
Yeah. You know, but Charles, without that scene, how would we know how Darth Vader, a man who got to his Star Destroyer? It's essential.
Yeah, you're right. I should just keep my mouth shut. but things like that, you know, it's just, to me, Empire was the most perfect of the three in its original version. It needed the less touch-up and less fixing, and therefore whatever got fixed tend to like hurt it. I feel like Empire was absolute perfection as is. So it was, those changes were unnecessary. Jedi was kind of like, why not take a shot at it? Try to make it better. I love the shot, the aerial shot on Tatooine of the Bantha herd, and then finding, you know, Jabba's sail barge. Mm-hmm. The cleanup of the two guys walking on the top of the barge is much better, obviously, than it was originally. You know, Sarlacc, it's fine. I didn't like it or hate it. It was fine. You know, Jedi rocks. Oh my God, I don't even want to talk about that. You know, if the kids love it, great. You know, it's like if a whole new generation comes in to see Star Wars in the big theater and they love that stuff, awesome. I'm glad that they...
As a kid who did come in and see Return of the Jedi for the first time at the movies, I can tell you at least this one child did not enjoy Jedi Rocks. It did not work for me.
They took like two of the coolest pieces of diegetic music in the Star Wars universe and just tossed them out the door, like, you know, the Yub Nub song and Lapti Nek.
Well, I really do love the new Victory Celebration cue at the end.
Same.
I think it's gorgeous. I think it's beautiful. It's much more, I think, in keeping with closure, because back then we were thinking that it was just going to be those three movies, you know, for sure. And it was just like this kind of peaceful resolution to the war. That was really nice. It still had a bit of like tribal Ewok music, you know, blended in there. But on the whole, I had this much more sweeping, almost spiritual sense to it that I loved. You know, the actual interplanetary celebration footage, it's fine. You know, again, it's sort of like, you would think that the Empire, it would take years for the Empire to fall. It wouldn't just all happen like that. But, you know, it's fine. It's a more of a symbolic montage to, like, show the fall of the Empire. So it's cool. But I do love that John Williams music. I mean, I think that is absolutely my favorite change in all of the special editions, for sure.
People pulling down statues is so unrealistic. It would never happen.
I know.
I'm conflicted about that, too, because, you know, I love both. I love the original Ewok song and the new way they've done it. And it's... It's kind of, that's the only piece I wish we could have both. You know, why not both?
Yeah.
In the same film, in a way, you know?
Well, for me, it's like Yub Nub works really well as a conclusion to like that movie, which is like largely being about Ewoks and fighting the Empire and Endor and whatever. But Victory Celebration works really well as a conclusion for like that whole story, like that whole trilogy of the Rebels fighting the Empire and, you know, coming to an end to this conflict. So yeah, for me, it's like it is one of the, it works either way. But I probably prefer Victory Celebration. Like I don't know. It just feels a little more sweeping and a little more like deserving of like the finale of the Star Wars trilogy.
That's right. I totally agree. And even the way that the Ewok party section is kind of edited a little more leisurely, it's a little more breezy, a little bit more footage, you know, seeing a little bit more of Wedge, you know, interacting, and it just feels like we're relaxing after a huge, huge battle that, you know, now everyone can find peace, you know, whereas before it was like, let's party. You know, and I'm not sure, with, you know, literally, you know, billions upon billions of people killed over the course of these wars, that let's party is maybe the first emotion you want to end.
What about you, Baz? Were there changes for you? Was there a particular change that really worked for you in the special editions?
I think my hands-down favorite, and I think this might be yours too, is just that split-second reveal of Han charging down the corridor in the Death Star and coming face-to-face with not just three or four stormtroopers, but like a whole launch bay full
like a whole assembly of stormtroopers. Yeah. And when he turns around and runs away, it's like the laugh lands more because, you know.
It just really sells that joke, you know.
Yeah.
It's very subtle, but it really sells that joke. Is that your favorite too, Rowan?
That's my favorite for sure. And least favorite would be Jedi rocks or adding, you know, and it's not his fault. Like I don't hold it against him at all. But adding Hayden to the end of Return of the Jedi, like what the hell? And he apparently didn't even know what they were filming when he was just kind of standing there, like cool man, just staring into the middle distance, having a great time. Like he it's not his fault it turned out the way it did.
Knowing what footage was out there and was available to them, Charles, why do you think they resisted putting the sandstorm scene in to Jedi?
It probably ruined the pacing because you had this really super exciting, you know, fight at the sail barge and this beautiful kind of like escape, right? The big explosion, they escape.
Yeah.
And then imagine, you know, you have this great edit and also with the music going from the skiff flying off, wipe Falcon and X-Wing and you know, above Tatooine. It's a beautiful transition. It's a beautiful escape, right? Now imagine skiff flies off and then run, like the energy just dies because you're walking a sandstorm. They're kind of like lost and looking for the Falcon and the Y-Wing and everything else. And they're kind of like looking around. And it's just like, I get it. It's another one of those moments where, it's a great deleted scene that I think should exist separately to enjoy.
Yeah.
But man, that would have completely ruined the thrill of escaping from the Sarlacc pit, you know, that whole battle.
Yeah. Charles, your box sets for Blade Runner and Alien are very much kind of the blueprints for what, you know, what I would hope like a truly comprehensive Star Wars box set would look like, in the sense that, you know, they bring together all the various cuts of the films. What's your stance on like a, you know, director's cuts or special editions in this case, like replacing the original editions in terms of availability?
Well, look, ultimately it's the filmmaker's call. I think that the Blade Runner set kind of shows you what I would do. You know, if I was calling the shots, which I'm not, but if I was calling the shots, I would probably do something along those lines to give everybody what they want. And I think it's possible. Now, granted, there's probably an entire other dimension of contractual things, legal things, personality things, you know, creative choice things that would apply to Star Wars that did not apply to Blade Runner. Like there's two entirely separate things, right?
Mm.
So with Blade Runner, part of the mission was to get all these versions out there because that film famously had multiple versions and a new one that we were going to, you know, finish the final cut. And I, as a fan and as someone who cares about film preservation, I felt like, well, if we can give it to people, why not? And that's what we did. And Warner Brothers was incredibly, incredibly generous with making that a reality. We would have meetings over the course of the few years we worked on Blade Runner. And, you know, one meeting, it was a one disc set, then it became a two disc set and a three. Then, all right, we're done. We got it's a four disc set. No more than that. And then I remember saying, you know, there's this other version of the film. There's the work print, which the fans really want. And then I had to explain what the work print was. And then by the end of that meeting, it was a five disc set. So it was just, and again, that was the beauty of working with Warner Brothers because they love movies. They cherish the history of films. Now, I mean, I think of all the studios, Warner Brothers has such a rich catalog of titles that they sincerely love and protect. So, and Blade Runner isn't even technically their film. They just release it, a distribution deal on it, but they still treated it with the love that they would give to another classic. So that was a really great experience because almost never heard the word no on that one, you know? So with Star Wars, it'd be interesting because it's like, you know, through seamless branching, which allows you to put multiple versions of a film on a single disc, you could get more than one or two or three versions of Star Wars on one disc if it was done smartly and you could actually figure out the pieces that are, you know, unique to a cut versus pieces that are redundant over multiple cuts. So it's just the math and the geometry and the, you know, three-dimensional chess of figuring out which piece goes with which version. But I think that again, strictly as a fan and my fantasy version of it, it would be like you get every version of the film and down to the nitpicky tiny details between versions. Because even though, you know, you could ostensibly say there's what, maybe four or five versions of the original Star Wars throughout the different, you know, home releases. There's probably more. I mean, you talk about different audio mixes and different little, just tiny little things, you know, that you could do. You just got to track it all and make sure you have to, you know, quality control the hell out of it to make sure that it is, you know, you can't have any imperfections in Star Wars. It has to be absolutely perfect because you're going to hear about it endlessly if you get it wrong.
Well, that's one of the things with, you know, with that's kind of unique about those films and about, I guess, George Lucas's approach is like he was tinkering with those from day one. So, you know, like literally, like, as you said, there's differences between, you know, the original Dolby stereo mix is very different to the mono mix and so on and so forth. Like, so yeah, when you talk about like the different versions, it's almost like the seven, you know, I think we generally, when fans talk about it, we talk about it in terms of like the 77, there's the special edition, there's the 2011 Blu-rays, but that's kind of like the basic bitch way of looking at like the changes when you really dig down into it. Like it's wild, like how many differences there are and like how many distinct versions of these films there are. I mean, what would you kind of see is like the, I suppose the main, like the most important sort of distinct cuts of Star Wars that you'd want to include on a home video release?
Well, I mean, for me, it'd be what was ever released in theaters first, you know, and probably if you, and if there are multiple versions released because of like 70 millimeter and other versions, I would go with the 70. But it you can't do it blindly. You have to, you really have to figure out which is best for the film. If we agree that the version of the film we're going to go with is from the one that was opening day in most of the big theaters, if there's two versions based on the sound mix or the audio track or whatever, you have to decide, well, which one of those is better? Is there a way to maybe blend those two? And then now you're creating a hybrid third version, which now people are like, start talking about, you know, it's like, these are the things you have to have long, thoughtful conversations about these things and really try to figure out, can you include everything? But My default is whatever was released opening day in like the biggest markets. Like I feel like that's your start point, but then you explore what else there is.
What do you make of the theory that's gone around over the years, or the story that the original negatives were destroyed in order to make the special editions?
Look, I'm not privy to any, you know, secret knowledge on this. I can only go off of my experience on Blade Runner, but we managed to put five versions of Blade Runner on a film that was really poorly archived. Again, not through anyone's fault. It was just the film bombed, you know, it bombed and it sat on the shelf and no one really thought about Blade Runner for many years. But we got five versions on there, including the work print, which looked terrible when we saw it. It looked like it had been dragged behind a truck and gravel. It was just so bad. And yet again, Warner's and the restoration team and everyone did the best they could with it. So on that Blade Runner set, you've got five versions of the film, all like at the time, state-of-the-art transfers, you know, all anamorphic, all like beautifully remastered. So my thinking is if we can do that with Blade Runner, surely there must be the elements out there to restore Star Wars in any number of iterations that need to be created, because no matter who has what at this point, there's always other people out there. There's private collectors, there's other sources, there's other ways to do it. When you look at what like Harmy has done with the despecialized versions. Again, not perfect by any means, not anywhere, you know, top of the line in terms of state of the art transfers, but man, it's good enough if you want to watch it. You know, it's like I have no problem putting that in and making that my preferred viewing experience with the original trilogy.
Same.
It's perfectly fine. Now, if we could get like the resources of an actual professional restoration done with the elements that Lucas and Disney and whoever else officially has those elements, and then anybody else out there that might have in their own private collections, like a 35 millimeter print or something, that again, it's just finding the pieces to do it. I don't believe it's possible to say that. I mean, you can say it, but I don't think it's true that it's destroyed and gone forever, the original version. It's like it's out there. It's either out there complete, just ready to go right now, or the pieces of it are out there to bring it together to make that. It's going to take some work. It's going to take some money, and that really, again, that's someone else's call. But I think if you wanted to do it, you could do it.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah, The prequels have also been altered quite a bit over the years. I mean, you know, like, for example, everyone sort of knows that there's the puppet Yoda version of the Phantom Menace, and then there's the digital Yoda version. I mean, if you were doing a set like this, would you also sort of preserve those alternate versions of the prequels?
Absolutely, because, I mean, for instance, with Phantom Menace, you can go with the original theatrical cut that also has puppet Yoda. Then you go with the home video release cut with the extra lap of the pod race, and then you could put in digital Yoda there, or whatever. And you can find ways to piece it together so you get the alpha and the omega of the film's editing, you know?
Yeah.
I was thinking about the other day, and it's like, you know, in that big Skywalker Saga box set that came out, I mean, I feel like, you know, the sequel trilogy, those are all pretty much good to go, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's no alternate versions that we know of that need to be restored, that need to be put on the disc. But the other six movies, so I feel like Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones would possibly need multiple versions. Sith, I'm not sure. And then the original trilogy, we all know there's tons of versions. But then you get to the sequels, and they seem to be, you know, locked and loaded and ready to go. So I guess it just depends on what scope you're looking at. And again, having now had this giant box set come out, like, what is the reason? What's, again, kind of like the goal with the new set? And the only thing I think of besides celebrating some future anniversary is the perfect set. Like, what is the perfect box set that's got everything everybody wants? And someone will say it's impossible to make everybody happy. And my response to that always is you can make most people happy.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we did that with Blade Runner. I think we made most people happy. I think with the Alien set, we made most people happy, you know, so much so that you don't hear a lot of, you know, static from angry fans.
Yeah.
So you should at least try. I feel like you should at least try to make everybody happy.
I wonder if we'd ever live in a world where all these versions went up on Disney Plus and you could just choose your preferred one.
Sure. I think that's absolutely the way it's going to, I mean, streaming is going to allow for, again, if they want to do that, streaming could allow for all kinds of those kind of like experiences of, you know, choose your own adventure, basically, you know? Mm.
You famously oversaw, as we've talked about, the final cut of Blade Runner. Do you think, you know, what's on Disney Plus now is, and this is just pure speculation at this point, do you think we've seen the final cuts of the original trilogy, or do you think we'll see more changes to these films down the line, like as special effects continue to improve over the years?
I mean, I think that a lot of that depends on George, if that's what he wants to do, if he wants to, you know, keep taking shots. I mean, we got the McClunky cut now, yeah. Right? the 4K. And again, it's like,
I can't believe we got this far without talking about, you know, the
McClunky. Yeah.
I remember like the day, like the morning that the original trilogy hit Disney Plus, and I kind of had heard through the grapevine that there might have been some tweaks, and I put it in. And McClunky came up, and I had to watch it like six times to make sure that this is new, right? I'm not imagining McClunky. Anyway. And so then I go on like Twitter, and like everyone it's like hashtag McClunky for the next week. So
yeah.
I think there's always going to be an opportunity, I guess, for George to tweak with it some more if he wants. Again, if he wants it, he'll probably get whatever he wants. I don't know. I mean, I kind of wonder just at what point is it okay to let it go? And then you have to ask at what point. Is it okay for like the next generation to maybe enjoy the version that they wanted or that they grew up with or whatever? I mean, that's the only problem I have with all of these multiple versions of Star Wars, that we are not allowed the original that we grew up with.
Yeah.
Officially, legally, you know?
Yeah.
And that's it. If you just kind of gave that up to fans, I think all of that tension and all that anger would just go away.
But I could not agree more. Like my stance on the special editions has always been like, you know, like as someone who, you know, who saw the first special edition as a kid, like, and understands, like, that's, you know, that helps get kids hooked on Star Wars. Like, I'm happy for them to just keep updating them forever if George wants to, or, you know, so they can sort of stand up against the modern blockbusters of the day and kids can keep discovering them, as long as the original cuts are also available. Like, if you make those first cuts available, like, I don't care what you do after that. Like, And I get it. Like, Star Wars is like, it's this modern mythology in a way that like really no other movie series is. So I understand the impulse to like keep updating that mythology for, you know, for new generations. But it's just like, Yeah, like as someone who like appreciates film history or whatever, I'm like, but don't you think like we should still be able to see? Like to me, it's almost like cheating. It's like, yeah, of course the film still looks great because you keep going in and updating it all the time, and it actually underwhelms. Like to me, it does a disservice to what they did with the original Star Wars, because like you watch the Hami cut and there's, you know, obviously you can see the age, you can see the things that would be done differently in the special editions, but for a movie made in 1977, it still looks amazing. And you lose that when you have these special editions, because you lose any sort of like, well, for a thing made in 1977, because it's like, well, it wasn't made in 1977. It was, you know, it was constantly updated over and over and over. So yeah, from that, like, wanting to be able to like see film history as it unfolded and compare, you know, well, this is what they could do in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and so on and so forth. It just seems like a no-brainer to make those original cuts available.
And you can even look at it from the point of view of it being more of a grown-up high-end product. If you wanted to do a kind of a standalone, almost like in a wooden box coffee table type elegant, you know, display of like, okay, this is the original like scrolls, right? The Journal of the Wills box set, right? And you could have like a beautiful just set of like, okay, these are the original theatrical releases of the films, period. Like that is it. Mm. It has nothing to do with the stuff we're putting out now. This is just for the old timers to, you know, to put on the shelf, hug when they want to hug it, and just like know that they've got it, you know? Mm. That would go such a long way. I think to making so many people happy. But again, I know it's kind of ridiculous to think about these things, but I do feel like you could, if you wanted to, you can make a lot of money going that route of just saying, okay, you want the original cuts, you're gonna have to pay for it, old timers, but have money now. here you go. Here's like this really elegant, expensive set. You're gonna get your cuts the way you want them, and we're gonna make a ton of money off of it. I'm fine with that. Seriously. If they wanted to do that, I'd say take my money. You know, yeah, I really would.
Yeah. It's funny, like you mentioned before, like, you know, obviously what they do with the special editions depends on what George wants to do. And you know, as a general rule, I think it's a pretty good rule of thumb that, you know, it should be the director's prerogative to alter a film and release alternate editions if they want. I guess like an interesting little wrinkle with that, though, is that George didn't direct Empire or Return of the Jedi. Do you think that matters in terms of him going back and making changes to it over the years?
I mean, it's a tricky area because since Irvin Kershner and Richard Marquand are no longer with us, they're not really here to make the case one way or the other. I can't imagine they would be against it. I mean, just given what maybe some of the statements that Irvin Kershner made late in his life, but George owns, or he owned the movies, you know, he was the executive producer on the sequels.
Yeah.
He financed them, you know? So I think it's fair to say in this case, it's almost like an executive producer on a TV series that has kind of like an extraordinary oversight over the creative of it. So yeah, on the one hand, I definitely am a big, you know, defender of the director's domain and their sort of overview of their creative stamp and their voice and everything like that. But Star Wars is kind of a unique situation where George is basically executive directing the movies anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was always his baby for sure.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny though, because presumably like almost every director walks away from a movie they've made saying, you know, I wish I could change this little detail, or I wish I could put that subplot back in, or whatever. Like, you know, presumably every artist who works on something, you know, never feels completely finished with it, but not every movie gets a director's cut. I mean, as someone who's, you know, worked on as many director's cuts as you have, like, what's kind of the mindset that a director is in when they're making something like this? Like, what sort of motivates a director to go back and give a film the director's cut treatment and, you know, not give another film the director's cut treatment?
Well, in the case of the ones that I worked on, largely it was fan-driven. Like, there was a demand for it, right? Mm-hmm. We knew that it would come out and a lot of people would be interested and they would pay for it. And that would therefore justify the great expense and the time and the effort to go do this cut. That's one facet of it. The other facet of it is how was the film received? How did the director take that reception? Were there conversations of, oh, if only I had done this, or if only I could have put this back in? And the studio generally is happy to have those conversations because it's a new product. You know, it's taking a title, refreshing the title, and putting out a new product of something that they can now make money off of, but it already has the the recognition. People already know what it is. You don't have to warm people up on a new movie. It's a movie people are familiar with, but it's a new version of it. So that's exciting.
Yeah.
So it was rarely a sense of, in my experience, of a director fighting the studio to get their vision, like Terry Gilliam style in Brazil. It wasn't, it was never like that. It was always more of like, I wish I could have done this. And the studio saying, well, what would you like to do? And then we all come together and it's like, well, how much is it going to cost? And what's it going to be? What's going to be involved? And how long is it going to take? And all that stuff. So it's very matter of fact, usually. In the case of Blade Runner, it was pretty extraordinary just because there were so many versions. And we had to keep asking ourselves, well, why a new version since there have already been all these other ones? And the answer to that always was, well, Ridley never got his true cut of the film, even with that so-called director's cut in 92. So now that we can sort of make it happen, now that the technology is there, and now that we can make a deal to get all the rights and the footage and all that stuff, it was the perfect storm for it to all come together to finally make the cut the way he wanted to make it. That's like a one in a million story, that one. Most director's cuts are pretty straightforward. It's just kind of like, is there a way to refresh the title? Do you, director, have anything you want to do with it? Is there stuff you wish you could put back in? How much is it going to cost? Is it worth it? Yes, let's do it. I've never had this like I mentioned before, like this kind of Gilliam-esque crusade where we have to screw the studio over and get the real movie out. It was never like that.
Yeah. You, we talked before about some of your early memories of Star Wars, and you were actually also at the first official screening of the original Star Wars trilogy as a whole. What do you remember about that?
Well, there were two official, well, I don't know if official is the right word, but there were two trilogy screenings that I was at. One was in 1984 at Worldcon in Anaheim. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of an unofficial, under the radar one, even though Carrie Fisher was there. I forgot. There were a lot of Lucasfilm people there. It was definitely, approved and supported by everybody. But they gave out these promotional buttons that said, I saw the trilogy, but didn't say Star Wars anywhere on the button.
Yeah. At the time, what other trilogy was there, to confuse it with?
Right. And it was in the Star Wars font, so you knew what we were talking about. But
yeah.
But that wasn't the official first trilogy. It just happened to be before the one you're talking about, which was in March of 85 at the Egyptian in LA. I'm sure it was other places around the world or the United States, but that was the first official one. And we camped out overnight to get tickets, my friends and I, which is ridiculous. But we could do it back then because we were dumb teenagers and we could just, spend night on Hollywood Boulevard and just not get killed. But we camped out and, it was fun because Maureen Garrett, who used to run the Star Wars fan club, she was there. Howard Kazanjian came down. I think Sid Gannis was there as well. And it was just fun because we were starting to, as fans, move beyond enjoying the movies as stories and now enjoying the movies as film productions and who were the people behind these productions and starting again, kind of like tiptoe towards the Lucasfilm type of people and try to, make some kind of connection beyond, hey, I love the movie, So that was really cool. And they gave out buttons there that did say Star Wars on it. And I still have my button. I still have my ticket stub. I have all that still. And it was a lot of fun. And I'm not going to lie. It was tough maybe towards the end of Empire and the beginning of Jedi to stay awake because we were up all night on Hollywood Boulevard. And you just kind of get your head nods a little bit. But it was still a beautiful experience just to see those films back to back to back like that.
Yeah. One of the things that people like myself love about like the Alien and Blade Runner sets is, first off, those sort of sprawling, 3-4 hour documentaries. But then, you look at the Alien set and even just the sort of micro level of detail, like all the little sort of mini docs and mini behind the scenes features you've got on there as well on just sort of every aspect of the film's production. I mean, when you look at something like Star Wars, especially the original trilogy, that's just been poured over and analyzed for over 40 years now. Like if you were working on a Star Wars box set, like are there, like what sort of aspects of the production would you kind of like to, look back at or document that you think kind of haven't been done to death at this point?
Well, you'd have to approach it journalistically and almost go backwards and start with the people that had small pieces of the story. Mm-hmm. Start with them because they're going to have like a little, the tiny little nooks and crannies covered versus the big broad strokes that you would get from George or Lawrence Kasdan or wherever, any of, like, you know, the top people. So you'd have to, I would try to go back and get as many of those people, of the crew, of the cast, and I hate to put it this way, but the older ones especially, because we're, you know, we're losing people. It's a reality, you know?
Yeah.
And so do that. And then I would say, you know, go through all the raw interview footage that has been, you know, amassed on other documentary projects that Lucasfilm would control, and just kind of see what stories haven't been told. I mean, it is, you're going to have to do a deep dive into what exists, find the holes that need to be covered some other way. I do this on every kind of older title. It's like, first I look at what's on the shelf. What do we have? What do we know that we have? And then what's missing? What gaps can we identify? And then start filling those gaps. And that generally results in a big, broad documentary with all these details. And you're not going to get everything. You're always going to miss something. There's always going to be someone online that's going to say, hey, there's this great story that happened here in this location and all that, and we miss it because it just didn't come up in the X number of months we had to put it together. Mm. If you're lucky, maybe get a year, if you're lucky. So it's a lot of deep diving. It's a lot of journalistic just hunting and talking to people and going through boxes and just trying to figure out what hasn't been told, but in a way that still serves the story that has been told and needs to be told again, because that's your spine, right? That's the foundation of the whole documentary. Mm. It's like the little bits of spice and flavor along the way that you might be able to give some new life to, you know? It's not easy. I mean, Star Wars has been done quite a bit. A lot has been done on Star Wars. It wouldn't be easy at all. But again, you'd have to like figure out, what's the goal of a new documentary? Not just to make it bigger and broader and more nitty gritty, geeky detailed, but, is it one long first chapter in an ongoing, like 9-chapter mega documentary that's spread across multiple discs, but still has kind of a uniformity of style of structure. Which is again, what I did with the Alien set, you know, it's like when I did the 4 movies, even when I went on to do Prometheus, I made Prometheus kind of like a cousin to the original 4. So it's not exactly the same, but structurally it's still very similar. Mm-hmm. You could put those 5 movies together and they fit as documentaries.
Yeah.
I would say that you would have to, you don't have to, but I mean, that's probably what I would try to do with the Star Wars thing, is to try to figure out what is the fit of the whole thing. And that's going to take some time. That's a long conversation to have with many important people to figure out, you know, what they want, what fans seem to want, what hasn't been done, what could be done better. It's a long conversation, but it's always interesting, I think. And there's probably going to be other opportunities for other people to go in and make their claim on the making of Star Wars in some way or another. I mean, that's why I love Jonathan Renzler's books, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I love reading his books because they're not video, they're not film, but they make you feel like you're there.
Yeah.
He had me consult a little bit on his Making of Alien book, and we had great conversations about it on the phone. And then when he actually sent me the early galleys to read, I was blown away because I thought, man, it's like you weren't there, but it feels like you were there. You know, his writing put you in the room with these people.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like, I think the guide moving forward for me is like, how do I find a way to go beyond just dry data and dry storytelling and put you in the room with these people when they were, you know, making these films?
Yeah.
I read recently that somehow 300 and something hours of on-set footage from A New Hope has come to light that's never been seen before. So I'm kind of interested in what that might throw up and whether there'd be anything in that might change the way you do a doc.
I mean, I haven't heard that. That'd be amazing if it's true. Mm-hmm. I do think that the new vintage behind-the-scenes footage in the Rise of Skywalker documentary, Skywalker Legacy, is phenomenal. I mean, that to me was like mind blowing. Because the new behind the scenes footage is great. It's beautifully done. But every time it went to vintage old school footage, I was just like, oh my God, there's so much more we haven't seen. Yeah. And this is just that little tip of the iceberg. It's like, imagine what we really haven't seen. So that would be fun to kind of go through and figure out like a whole new experience for people who think they've seen everything.
It does seem though, like there's far less of these very sort of sprawling, comprehensive, warts and all making of documentaries being produced now for DVDs and Blu-rays. And, you know, that the docs we do get are often, you know, sometimes kind of indistinguishable from what might be in, you know, an electronic press kit. Like, is that just a byproduct of the move away from physical media, do you think? Or is it a case of maybe studios being worried about putting, you know, too much of the behind the scenes story out there?
I don't think it's the latter. I don't think it's they're worried about putting too much behind the scenes story out there. I do think it has to do with just an evolving viewership. It's people that, you know, who had back in 1997, 98, who had, you know, maybe like 20 or 30 VHS tapes laying around the living room, suddenly being introduced to this sexy new format called DVD that was like much, much better picture. You could have extras, it's $20, you know, whatever. And you could build libraries of this stuff. And like, that was super exciting for probably what, like a decade. Mm. And then, you know, economy tanked, people had less money to spend. People had seen it, done it, been there. Like, you know, I know how movies are made now. Thank you very much. I don't need to like buy the making of Big Mama's House, you know? So it's like, there's just so many different like ways to entertain yourself. And I think people were just kind of ready to move on. And Blu-ray, as great as it is, had a format war, which was around the time that Blade Runner was happening, was HD DVD and Blu-ray were kind of both jockeying for the high def market. So that kind of confused things even more. So people who had spent all this money on DVDs didn't want to like gamble and invest in the wrong format if that was going to be the one that tanked finally, that was going to lose the war. So that was an awkward beginning. And then eventually streaming kicks in. So it's like there's never really been a good, I don't know, evolutionary moment for physical media. So it kind of stopped. It still happens on a rare occasion. You get a nice big long documentary and a robust series of extras, which, by the way, I have to say, there's a lot of indie home video labels. Like, I mean, Criterion, Shout Factory, Arrow. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many of these places that are doing a lot of like content, you know, I mean, really robust packages of like 2, 3 disc, 4 disc sets. Mm. I just ordered like this mega, I forget if it's 7 or 8 discs, Dawn of the Dead box set from the UK that's going to come out in October, just because I want to have everything in this giant Dawn of the Dead box. So I think there's still the demand for it. It's more niche now. It's more like the Laserdisc days of old, where just the mega nerds want that stuff. But I do think with streaming and stuff like Disney Plus and some of the other studios that are getting into streaming, I think that there's going to be opportunities to do supplemental material like making up documentaries or deleted scenes. I mean, you're already seeing that a bit on Disney Plus anyway, but less as just kind of like an afterthought and more of like a really robust, you know, kind of story that needs to be told. And I feel like the Mandalorian making of is a big first step in that direction to see like, oh, you're going to take one show and you're going to make a show out of the making of the show and just kind of like let that evolve. And hopefully season 2 will be more of that. And hopefully it'll become more and more in depth. I don't know if you guys were watching it, but I mean like the episode 4 of this one, the technology episode.
Yeah.
I cried during that episode because of the new technology available.
Yeah.
I thought, oh my God, this is like the next big thing that all of us need to think about in terms of world building, in terms of storytelling, in terms of the pandemic and making films in like isolated spots, you know. When I saw episode 4 of Making a Mandalorian, I thought, oh my God, this is it. This is the thing we all need to start, you know, getting very comfortable with. And not only comfortable, but excited about, because I feel like there's so many opportunities and potential with that. Mm. So, yeah, we're in a transitional time. That's basically it. It's transitional. Mm. Things are changing and people are changing. And obviously we have a new normal that we don't even know if that's normal yet. Like, we don't know what the hell's going on. So we have to kind of figure that out before I think we can have a game plan.
Yeah, and I had the same reaction to, you know, seeing the volume in episode 4 of the Mandalorian and just seeing, you know, just thinking like, oh my God, like imagine if, you know, were he ever to come out of retirement, like if George got to make something with this technology that he kind of helped clear the way for, or even like Ewan McGregor coming back and doing that, the Obi-Wan Kenobi series, you know, a guy who worked on all the sort of green screen bound stuff with the prequels and now getting to sort of play in this environment with the Kenobi series. I mean, the stuff we're going to see over the next few years is it's going to be amazing.
Maybe George comes back and does the Mandalorian Christmas special.
We can only hope.
Baby Yoda gets his life day presents.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Charles, man, thank you so much for coming and talking with us today. I mean, where can people sort of find you on the internet and hear more from you?
I'm starting to fade on social media a bit. I'm kind of like in a zone now where I'm kind of thinking, hey, maybe I'm going to just back off a bit, but I'll probably still be on Twitter. So at Lauzirika, Lauzirika. You can find me there. But I'm still on Facebook and other things. I'm feeling very strange about just social media right now. And I just kind of feel like maybe I'll just take a little break. I'm being very productive off, you know, social media these days. I want to keep that going. But that's the long answer to your short question.
do you have anything you can sort of tease in terms of that productivity, like anything you're working on that you can mention, or is it all sort of hush hush kind of stuff?
I shouldn't mention the title, but a script that I wrote, about a decade ago, suddenly has like new traction as a series. It was a feature script, and now we submitted the series breakdown, and now we're having conversations about, you know, what's next for that. And if that happens, that's going to be huge, and I'll gladly turn my life over to that because that'll be a big, big thing for me. So there's that, and then I'm writing. I just started writing a low budget indie kind of horror movie, a monster movie that I'm super excited about. That really talks about what's happening today in the world. It's basically my COVID frustration. Yeah. I'm typing. It has nothing to do with COVID. First of all, I want to tell you that because there's going to be a million and one scripts coming out about COVID and about like how, you know, it's not that at all. But it was the frustration of that fueled the script. So I quit like Instagram for a minute and I kind of stopped doing social media, and man, I powered through like 20 pages in 2 days, and I was like, wow, this is really coming pretty well. So that's where I'm at in the creative flow.
Awesome. All right, guys. Well, that's where you can find Charles, and it sounds like there's plenty of stuff to look forward to coming out as well. In the meantime, if you want to follow us on social media, we are pretty easy to find. We're at Force Material on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Mostly Twitter. Look, we probably should take a step back from social media, but we'll probably still be on there. If you have any messages for us that cannot be contained by the limits of social media, feel free to drop us an email at forcematerial@gmail.com. And if you enjoyed this chat with Charles, feel free to drop us a look. You know, if you wanted to hit us up on your podcast platform of choice and drop a 5-star review, we're not gonna say no. It's a free country. You do what you want. You can also obviously, this is day one of our virtual Star Wars celebration, making up for the real thing being cancelled this year. So stay tuned over the next couple of days. We'll be pumping out the content for the next few days of what would have been Star Wars celebration. I'm Rowan Williams.
I'm Baz McAllister.
I'm Charlie DeLazarica.
And you've just taken your first step into a larger world.